Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming today. Actually, my presentation will be focusing on a practical experience in integrating mental health into the community and community health and rehabilitation programs. And it's based actually on a study that has been conducted by a local university called Bir Zeyt University, which revealed that the overall context, the social and political context in Palestine, is affecting mostly young population, young people and children under the age of 18. So I will start with saying something about understanding and approach to mental health. Mental health covers wide-ranging problems and conditions. Those include psychiatric disorders, other conditions such as learning disability, and severe distress, especially during conflict and war, affecting the large majority of the community. In our context, in our political situation context, we believe that the symptoms that have been accompanying different groups of the community has resulted in social suffering. So the symptoms are to be linked to the overall condition, which is social suffering, not mental illness. And this is the model that we understand the social suffering based upon it. So we believe it's people like us who live between the ease and the dis-ease continuum, mostly in this gray area. So if we want to talk about the majority of the population, they are located in this area between ease and dis-ease, which is a black area. Our target population in the occupied Palestinian territories, the majority of mental health projects focus on black area, giving very little attention to the social suffering and severe distress. So the main intervention that have been there during the last years were focusing on actually the black area through drugs, through medications, and through other means of mental health interventions. And gray area was completely neglected. The result, people located in the gray area actually can either be led to the black by professionals, to the black area by professionals, such as the over-diagnosis of PTSD mainly, or left to suffer severe distress, deteriorating over time to reach the black area. The rationale and context of our understanding to the overall conditions. Since September 2000, intensified conflict, poverty, closure and siege, and negative impact of people's has resulted actually on negative impact on people's mental health or mental well-being. The community problems or social factors as have been presented, the increased violence within outside community, severe unemployment, and the accompanying social factors that are affecting life conditions of people, increasing dropout rates from schools and universities, severe exposure to violence, whether political or internal violence actually, and increased internal violence inside the schools. These are the features that have resulted from the situation in Palestine. This is the model that is also present our understanding to the social factors, the social causes to mental health, or the link between the social factors and mental disorders. We believe that economic deprivation, malnutrition, this leads to lead to malnutrition, domestic violence, mental ill health, economic impact, reduced productivity, disability, and I would say also stigmatization for certain social strata. social causes of distress require social intervention. This is exactly how we understand the approach, that the approach here should be through social actions, not through mental health classical methods or mental health classical interventions. Most of the population negatively affected by the severity of the conflict fall into the gray area of the dis-ease continuum. Interventions provided were mainly with classical mental counseling orientation. Social causes distress require social interventions strategies. In contrast, new methods in psychological support were developed mainly through home visiting activities. The second, social actions building resilience of communities, especially amongst youth. This is exactly what have been implemented on the ground. Working with communities, when we talk about interventions at the social level, at the community level, we're talking about working with communities, empowering them. Communities participate in setting their own priorities and are engaged, you know, in decision on issues related, to their living. And in this sense, every program in every locality takes on own life in relation to communal needs or community needs. An eye towards the future. Palestinians cannot afford to build new systems, new programs with regard to psychosocial support. The idea was how to integrate the component of psychosocial support into the community-based rehabilitation programs and primary health care provision or programs at the community level. And this is exactly what we started to do. We included the psychosocial support intervention into one of our programs, which is the community-based rehabilitation program. We started a pilot in a village called Hawara. Young people were targeted actually within this age group between 15 and 2021. Youth are taking initiatives by themselves, engaging in trying to solve some of their own problems and also communities' problems. In the process, they are being trained in leadership and being empowered, through social action. The case of Hawara, the girls, actually the group was mainly composed of female young people. They were, identified an objective to help some people with disability, and they identified one person with disability in the village, and they started to contact community resources, including the municipality, the village council, etc. This is also I just want to relate what is in here in terms of practical experience with the social resources that you presented, and how you utilize social resources through these, through trying to empower the local groups and to motivate them in order to do social action. Where we are going from here, based on the current success of the pilot, our plans include first a gradual expansion of the pilot. As we go along, we want to design relevant training for both the youth and the workers themselves, whether they are rehabilitation workers or community health workers working at primary health care level. Lessons are to be learned from the pilot on intervention strategies, not only through home visits, but also other kind of interventions of psychosocial support orientation. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have a seat.
No, I will
be pleased to have a seat, please.
You are commanded by the chair. Thank you very much for your thought-provoking presentation. We have the luxury of having some time for a Q&A with you. What I will do, since we have many people who came late, I would like to make just a brief summary of what's been covered and raise a couple of questions and then open it up for comments and questions from all of you. We have been really privileged to have some really tremendously thought-provoking presentation, focusing on youth from Uganda, from Liberia, Kurdish youth, and Palestinian youth. One of the cross-cutting issue for all of these presentations, if I were to choose one word, anybody would care, what word would you choose as a cross-cutting issue for all of these presentations? You may or may not agree with me, but let's hear. Anybody? Which?
Resilience.
Resilience, that's the positive, and then the negative, and what is the cause of the what?
Poverty.
What else?
Isolation.
I would say trauma. Trauma is the cross-cutting issue. That poverty is traumatic, not having food is traumatic, not having education is traumatic, all of those. The cross-cutting issue is trauma through its many manifestations. What it has to do with political discrimination, military occupation, gender discrimination, lack of education, no clothing, etc. No access to clean water, you name it. Now, one of the issues that was not discussed that is relevant to this, I believe, and I'd like to hear also from you and from the panel, we have not attended in any depth with, are there any protective factors? And the issue of protective factors, I'm raising it because it's an understudied area. We do so many studies, very far and few between on protective factors. We talk about resilience, but we don't talk sufficiently about protective factors. I must say, I had a naughty thought about and hearing Dr. Gerard talking about all the violence going on. You know, who does most of the violence in the world by gender? Men. But the group that they chose to be involved to heal are the girls. I have some concerns about that. I think we need to kind of think about not separating who the healers are and who the victims are. In fact, involve both perpetrators and victims in the healing process in a way that it is not cut by gender. So keep these issues in mind. I was pleased to hear from all of our presenters the kind of a comprehensive approach that they took in their research, and all of them, all four of them, are keenly interested not just in the beauty and the elegance and the satisfaction of the research, but also its application and how this is going to make a consequential difference in changing what is. And I was particularly also impressed with the last presentation, with ending in a very concrete community primary care based integration of a very complex issue. I will take one comment from each of the panelists briefly to respond to what I said, then we open it up to all of you, and we'll have to finish at 5:10, because I have to rush to my book signing, and to which all of you are invited right across the seat in Expo Hall. Just a brief comment, reactions to what you heard from me and what you hear from others.
And no, I agree. The term that came to mind, if I would have to pick a word for all of us, I mean, really vulnerability was the term that I think
right.
I would have used. I lots of lessons learned, and again, the approach that we used here was a very simplistic one, but I think it speaks to the larger issue of, again, vulnerability, social
right.
issues, support, and all that. So
great.
Looking forward to the dialogue with you.
Dr. Gerard, brief comment from you.
Brief comment, yes, there are commonalities when it comes to all presentations, and I think, as you said, you started saying that the commonalities are mainly related to, first of all, vulnerability and how we respond to this kind of vulnerability and how we can build resilience.
Right.
And this is exactly what we are applying whenever it comes how to deal with the, factors that of social and political nature that are affecting
right.
the quality of life of communities and how to respond and how to build the resilience of our community to cope with the difficulties. And in our case, we mainly targeted young people. And when we talk about women in our community, we talk about the most vulnerable group within the
Great.
Community. So we targeted women in order to build the resilience and to strengthening this component into social.
Dr. Hall.
So first I want to say I'm just really, really pleased to be a part of this panel today. I think all the talks were very, very thought-provoking. Dr. Girard's talk in particular spoke to me because it really targets in a community-based action approach the kind of resources that I was trying to highlight and the importance of in my talk. It's taking it to the next step. So resources are important, social support is important, and building those kinds of mechanisms within the community strengthens the community, and I think that's a good example of that. One thing that you mentioned about gender also I think is important for us to reflect on also, because a lot of the work that's done in the intervention context is targeting the victims, but the perpetrators are also victims. And the cycle of violence that's continued in a lot of these contexts are actually men. Okay, so men are the culprits here, right? So we forget about men also being victims, and they're perpetuating a cycle of violence because of their own trauma. I was in the DRC recently, and in that context, it was particularly clear to me that the men who were rejecting their wives and exacting violence in their own homes were also victims because their wives were victimized.
Right.
Or their wives were raped. They were victimized. And the programs, although they were rich and important in that context, were not targeting the men's mental health. And therefore, although the programs were effective in treating women's mental health, it wasn't effective in terms of bringing those women back to the same context that are just going to be victimized again.
Dr.
Fu? Just to build on what Dr. Hall said, for our study, it was not just psychosocial, it also included gender-based violence, because where we saw psychosocial health being impacted was primarily through sexual and gender-related I heard a lot of similarities with the situation in Liberia and Dr. Girard, and so I think that there's a lot that we can learn from when looking at social interventions and community focus. Right now we're looking at classrooms, but we hope to expand into the community to create that social engagement between out-of-school youth and
Before we open, I just wanted to first of all thank all of you for coming. We are really pleasantly surprised to see that there's standing room only, though there are a couple of seats available. Floor is open. When you make your comment, ask your question, tell us first who you are and what's your interest in this area. Anybody? Yes, sir.
I'm Tom Davis. I'm with Food for the Hungry, and I've been excited about this for a long time, but I work with food security. And in particular, there's this new study that came out that showed that if we could eliminate maternal depression, we could decrease stunting 29%. That made me extremely excited, knowing we can now maybe use that resource to do mental health programming. But one thing I've wondered is, knowing what we do in industrialized countries, and that attributional style has such an impact on whether someone is resilient or not, that learned optimism, is anyone doing studies in developing countries in particular to look at how do different people frame adversity and the impact that has on depression?
Anybody would care to respond?
I think it's intriguing, but I really don't know. Very intriguing.
I thank you for the question. I think it is really, in a way, relates to what Dr. Girard was talking about. We need to get out of the strictly medical clinical frame and think about a public health prevention, promotion, health protection frame. That step the professionals haven't taken yet. And maybe it will be organizations like yours challenging us to not be stuck in the old frame of a 19th century, 20th century medicine or public health frame, and to think about what are the affirmative, protective initiatives that can be taken long before there is trauma and the consequences of it. Anybody else would like to respond to this question from the group too? You are a resource as well, beside the panel. If not, we'll move on. Next. Who? Yes, ma'am. Tell us who you are, please.
And so, being Arab, I live in both contexts. So I find it very interesting. How do you think that the social resource of coming from a collective society influences the support system to reduce post-traumatic stress disorder, or creating resources to help later on in youth? How that can all be affected together?
Dr. Girard, fresh from the field.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's a very difficult question. First of all, relying on the community resources, mobilizing them in order to interact with them, is the first priority. And here, you know that it's not easy, and you know, to get people mobilized, it takes a lot. Second, to have young people realize their role in their own community, and not to be in this circle of marginalization, because the attitudes from the community towards young people is in a way trying to not outcast them, but not to get them involved into, you know, the community dynamics. And so to have this kind of interaction between both young people and community resources which are available to mobilize this process of communication, open channels, dialogue within the community, I think this will lead to a new process where we can identify new resources and where we can do the building of resilience at the community, at the overall community level. But our idea is, you know, understand first that the suffering in a turmoil, in a political condition like ours, is a suffering, it's not a mental illness. And the methods should be relevant and coherent with the situation, which is, you know, not psychosocial intervention, but mainly social intervention that will lead to the psychosocial support. So this is the idea.
One question on the issue of, you described the collective society, and Dr. Fu referred to how youth are defined. And I think we are entering an arena of the cultural determinants of how decisions are made and to what extent youth is empowered or not to participate, particularly if we conceptualize it through a social systems rather than through a medical system or a public health system. And we all know, and no news to anyone in this room, I'm sure, the Arab Revolution was ignited by youth in a collective society, but led and ignited by youth. So there is a new phenomenon in what you refer to as collective society, where youth are now coming to the fore and are playing a non-traditional role for that society, that of leadership. So one of the important issues that we need to think about, and I'd like to hear what you think, the panelists and you, we are at a kind of a transformational moment globally where youth in traditional and non-traditional cultures are playing increasingly important leadership roles that are not traditionally validated. It's breaking with tradition. So the issue is, how do we maintain tradition without marginalizing youth? And how youth can exercise leadership without ignoring tradition? And I think that is a major challenge for all societies, collective or individualistic. So I'd like to hear if you have any thoughts in that context, because Dr. Fu raised that issue of definition, and it occurred to me that it stimulated the thought of this seismic changes that are taking place now worldwide, illustrated most dramatically by the Arab Spring. But it's not just about the Arab Spring, but that is one of the most dramatic such. Any thoughts from the panel or from the group? And how this applies or enters into the area of psychosocial distress, public health, changing of health system, primary care, whichever way you want to take it. Yes, ma'am, tell us who you are, please.
Hi, my name is Mary Gabri, and I'm a psychologist that works with torture survivors in the States and in exile. And I just retired from Heartland Alliance, so I'm...
Now you have more time to do things.
Exactly. I'm finding that I'm busier than ever. But one of the things I think that all the presentations for me and in my work, the struggle, I think, is, you know, we come in with funding based on a proposal that we developed, and then you get on the ground, and I think one of the benefits, one of the projects I've worked with in Rwanda, it's been more organic with the feedback comes up to us, because we don't have any big funding.
Bottom up.
It's every year scrambling, can we continue, but each element of the project comes organically up. It's identified by the people on the ground who are working. And I wonder wonder, you know, what I struggle with, and it's like, how can we be more responsive to, as international players, to the identified needs of the community, rather than as an observer coming in saying, well, this would be interesting to know more about. And I wonder if any of you have thoughts of, I mean, it's sort of been, it's responding to you, because it is more of a public health model to have the community tell us, rather than...
Sure. Anybody would like to answer? I have some thoughts, but I'd like the panel first.
So I don't presume to know the answer to this question.
Right.
Complex, and obviously you've been in these contexts for longer than I have. But in the work that we've been doing, we've been working with International Rescue Committee, for example. And so they are in the local context, and they do work with the local community in different places that we have projects to identify what the local needs are. And then it's a matter of a technical assistance role rather than a top-down approach of knowing what the solutions are to a problem that is more complex than we could even understand. So I think there is building that trust in a community, and that's facilitated by working with local partner organizations like IRC, and then also implementing a mixed methods type of methodology, which enables one to talk with people, to understand what they're experiencing, understand their context from their viewpoint and their symptoms from their viewpoint. And then to see what the best science has to offer, see what we could do that's been shown to be effective in other settings.
I think Dr. Gerard gave us a model that they're practicing in the Palestinian territories, where yes, they established the girls' help group, but they, remember what he said, they consulted and consulted with the local council. So the model of identifying what is the local culture and leadership in the local culture, and involving both the people and the leaders in informing what their priorities are, rather than coming from Johns Hopkins and telling them, now I'm going to research this area. So, but that model doesn't quite exist yet. It is not institutionalized yet. But I think you're raising a very important issue as to what is the relationship between the scientific community, the donor community, the service community, and the local communities and cultures and traditions, whereby science and this methodology of science is necessary but insufficient in carrying out field-based studies that is not taking into account the cultural specificity and the local sensitivities. We'd like to hear responses from all of you about this issue. It's a very important issue. Anyone? Yes, ma'am.
Opportunity and institutionalized mechanism that's coming forward. USAID traditionally has given money to either U.S. universities or to their local missions to run projects, as you've identified. One of their current mechanisms, the acronym is PEER. Do people know about this one? So in the PEER mechanism, it's a partnership between AID and NIH, and it requires the PI to be from a university in one of those developing countries. So in partnership with us, they're driving it, but we provide support. So these kind of opportunities, we need to put proposals in and show folks that this is the kind of partnered work we want to do. And of course, it depends on there being folks in the university settings in Rwanda, in Ethiopia, in Tanzania, in these places that want to do work and have the opportunity. They're overworked, just like faculty here. In Rwanda, there's a vet school in the north. We put a proposal in with them. They don't have enough PhD-prepared faculty. Most of their faculty are Ugandan expats. I mean, we all know what the issues are, but if we will continue to respond to some of these opportunities, I think we will let funders know, and it will become more institutionalized, that this kind of partnered approach is key.
Dr. Gerard, do you like it?
From our experience, actually, there are certain frames that are developed. And those frames are related to, first, certain models, certain pre-set models in the minds of the donors. And let me be frank with you, certain political frames that are dictating you know, the overall aid policy in the country, that's the overall development policy in the country. In our field in health and, you know, social development field, I think in our country, our experience was not encouraging with USAID, because both frames, political frames and otherwise frames, are, you know, put forward, and one should fit into those frames, not, you know, help people in the country to develop their own frames, in cooperation, of course, with universities, because the role in, of universities and academia should be a role of a technical assistance partner, rather than being, you know, imposing certain frames and models on the existing context. So,
do you find the same with European Union, the same barriers and challenges?
More or less, yes. But
let me raise another issue. One of the issues that is all of this is raising is the issue of the workforce. Who is working in the field on these issues, aside from the research?
And
I think traditionally the workforce has been conceptualized as a professional workforce, mm-hmm. doctors, PhDs, nurses. Mm-hmm. There is a concept that is gaining significant traction because there was a bias among the Western researchers and professionals that somehow certain diseases are just going to happen only in the well-to-do world. Well, in fact, that is not true. Non-communicable diseases now are just as spread in the developing world as are in developed nations. And there just aren't enough health professionals to attend to the need. So one of the issues that is now gaining traction regarding the so-called health workforce, it's not just health, it's social, it's many other things, is to do what is called task shifting, meaning involving increasing number of others who may not have the MD or the PhD, but can be with some basic training, fulfill certain needs, and tremendously augment geometrically the health workforce. I'd like to spend a minute on that, if that's of mutual interest, if anybody would like to either bring in some examples or any thoughts you have from other people who haven't heard yet. We'll come back to you in a second. I know you have many ideas. Anybody else would like to weigh in or hear from? The silent majority. Anybody? Yes, sir.
Well, I'm a family doc in North Dakota, but I'm on the board of Global Health Ministries, GHM.org. We're Lutheran, but one good thing about Lutherans is we're not very religious.
Well, you won't ask how you're going to vote in this election, can you?
No. We trained our nurses to do cataracts and cesareans and everything, and we're just starting to move towards getting our nurses involved in doing counseling. And it's interesting to hear more about how one would do that.
So you are breaking that barrier. You are empowering your nurses to do something above and beyond what is specified in their work profile.
We broke that long ago, but now we're just starting to think about mental
health. Great. Well, there was another comment. I forget. Someone here wanted to say. Yes, ma'am. Tell us who you are, please.
Hello. My name is Chomani Walter. I'm currently an MD at John Hopkins. But in commenting on the issue that you just raised, I find it interesting, especially with a lot of research that you all did, that looking at you as victims in a lot of these situations, and sometimes there's a jump or a skip over the youth that are perpetrators, which, you know, a lot of that depends on social contacts and things that have been going on in those countries for years. But I think that it's a lot easier, and for example, in Nigeria currently, there's a lot of issues going on, and a lot of, you know, bombings and killings and things like that, and most of it are being carried out by people under 30. So, you know, you look at these situations.
Mostly men, I gather.
Yes. you look at these situations, you look at those who are on the ground trying to work with it, are hitting other youth with, you know, mentoring and trying to pull these people who are committing the violence away from the areas that they live in. So I guess I'm making a double point here, but one aspect is to really look at some of the youth who are the perpetrators and how they are called in, or what leads to them causing that violence, and also the pairing of, you know, non-PhD, down, you know, down to earth, on underground people to work with those who are in that perpetrating situation and trying to make that connection.
Okay, sir.
Yeah, I was just thinking of a quick example. World Vision in Uganda partnered with Johns Hopkins. They did a program to reduce depression at the community level, and they tried to get health providers to be the ones actually doing this interpersonal therapy for group. They were just too busy, so they had their younger brothers, sisters, people that they knew who were just like high school graduates actually do the intervention and had tremendous results. And so they showed that it did not have to be even a health professional carrying this
out. Right. And to follow that point up, that was actually my co-authors that did that study with World Vision. And I had mentioned that I was in the DRC recently, and I was there to train. I'm a clinical psychologist, and so I was there to train local mental health workers to provide cognitive processing therapy, which is one of two empirically supported treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder. Not medicalized, but that was the approach that was taken in this setting. And the people that we were training they didn't have a high school education. And cognitive processing therapy is a complex intervention with lots of moving parts. It took 2 weeks to train it. We made it very simple, and they implemented it, and the randomized clinical trial showed a tremendous results. Effect sizes that we would boast about in a clinic in the United States. So the task shifting modality is actually a really useful tool.
Ma'am, you are first, and then you are next. Sir, please,
Rahima
ma'am.
Could you
say your name again? Put here.
Rahima Baya.
From?
Rahima.
From?
University of Miami.
Great.
I just want to, just want to put out there that the World Health Organization released a report and some of them are integrating mental health into primary care. And they looked at that notion of past shifting across 11 countries. So that is work there, the literature.
Thank you.
Megan O'Connell from Washington, D.C. I do integrated medicine research for the military. But I had a similar experience. I was in the Gambia, and on all of the polio campaigns and vaccination clinics, nutritional surveillances, it was sort of like the whole team would come together, and the ambulance driver and even some of the maintenance workers at the clinic were giving immunizations because it was a totally necessary step where it's only, you know, the entire healthcare system there is run by nurses, basically, so it was really critical and important.
Would want to close with a few reflections. Thank you, first of all, for your coming and participating. Thank you for your rich feedback and suggestions. A few takeaway lessons from the panel and from you is that suffering is massive in the world. Violence is pervasive. Trauma is abundant. But there's hope. We have new ways of approaching it that does not rely exclusively on medical or public health models, though we still need them. We need to enhance those who deliver the care, who need not have professional degrees, but with sufficient training and continued support and supervision can markedly enhance the workforce. And we could relieve the suffering in an integrated model with primary care and all others who want us help, from education, from social services, and all services relevant to people's well-being. Thank you very much. God bless you.